All stores in that mall are required to open by midnight. Noel is speaking out against a growing trend, stores opening earlier and earlier on Thanksgiving every year. She told a television station that Thanksgiving should be spent with family and friends. Meanwhile, the mall's general manager says the holiday hours are in response to what customers want. He said the shoppers dictate the hours of operation. WGTD News Time is 10 past 8. Just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. The NBA, the Bucks beat the Oklahoma City Thunder 85-78 in Milwaukee last night. The Bulls were off. Bucks and Bulls are both off tonight. The NHL, the Blackhawks beat Tampa Bay 3-2 in a shootout in Chicago last night. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, November 12th, partly sunny, breezy, and cold, a high of 33. Tonight, sunset 431, cloudy and breezy, scattered flurries, overnight low 20, and then tomorrow, Thursday, cloudy and breezy, again some scattered flurries, tomorrow's high only 32. This morning, blue sky, sunshine, wind is from the west at 10, 22 degrees in Racine. 21 this morning in Kenosha, 20 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill is 10 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time 8:11. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. It is always a privilege for me to be able to speak with military historian Patrick O'Donnell, who has written any number of fascinating books that delve into often shadowy and largely obscure but fascinating chapters of America's military history, including often some of the most daring work which has been done behind the scenes, behind a cloak of secrecy, often operations which made all of the difference in the world in whether or not the United States could gain ultimate victory in some of its most hard-fought conflicts. And I have had the pleasure of speaking with Patrick O'Donnell on several different occasions about books like Beyond Valor, They Dared Return, and others. His latest book, which is conjuring up or generating much conversation and attention, is a book called First Seals, The Untold Story of the Forging of America's Most Elite Unit. This harkens back to the Second World War and to some of the first work which was done in what we might now think of as special operations. And it's really how the U.S. Navy SEALs began their extraordinary legacy. And some unforgettable characters and some amazing adventures are part of this real-life story. And this book is published by Da Capo Press. I'm delighted to be able to welcome back to Patrick O'Donnell to the morning show. Mr. O'Donnell, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
And you were just saying before we went on the air that as we are recording this interview Monday morning, that apparently all kinds of new and exciting attention is being given to the book. Tell us what's going on.
The Associated Press did a story on First Seals and one of the last surviving First Seals out there, one of the men in my book, a close friend of mine, Frank Monteleone, and the Associated Press, the story hit the AP wire, which means it goes worldwide, and it's going viral now around the world in scores of newspapers and blogs, etc.
I understand that you met Mr. Monteleone about 15 years ago, and tell us a little bit more about him and what this initial encounter with him has led to.
This is one of my closest friends as far as World War II veterans go. He's my daughter, who's 14 years old, calls him Uncle Frank, and we're kind of part of the family, and Frank is extraordinary. He's like many of the men of the maritime unit of the OSS. He was a tailor after the war, but during World War II was quite a renaissance man. He rode in on inflatable mattresses in the dead of night to drop off supplies and actually infiltrated enemy lines. He was Moberg's operator, radio operator, during World War II, and Moberg is a fascinating story. He was a pitcher for a Major League Baseball team and spoke about seven major languages, but also was sent behind the lines to assassinate Werner Heisenberg, the German scientist that was behind the atomic bomb for Germany. And this Frank is an extraordinary man. Every day, well, before I went to the Battle of Fallujah, Frank sent me one of his treasured possessions, which was a scapula. It's 85 years old. And I wore that in the Battle of Fallujah, and I've worn it every day since.
Wow.
And around my neck. I consider it probably one of my most prized possessions. And, you know, the Frank's story is like scores of other men that I interviewed in this book. And, you know, tragically, it's a generation that's passing.
Hmm.
Many of my close friends.
Fortunately, you are helping to preserve some of these extraordinary stories, which at least to some extent might be otherwise entirely lost to us. One of the most important stories about how all of this began, the long storied history of the Navy SEALs, is the extraordinary deficit under which the United States was operating as it entered the Second World War. A deficit that was very apparent in some ways in terms of number of mobilized troops and so on, but also a deficit when it came to matters behind the scenes. You tell us that prior to the Second World War, no national intelligence agency existed, and America lagged far behind the world's major powers. Tell us more about how we were sadly outdistanced by other major nations in the world at this crucial moment in our history, and what sort of desperate game of catch-up we had to play.
In 1941 and 1942, it is nothing like today, where we have, you know, developed Navy SEALs and special operations forces, Green Berets, etc. None of that existed in 1941. And what's so amazing is that men and women from all walks of life came together in the OSS. Extraordinary men and women. Renaissance men and women, actually. I mean, for instance, none of this technology even existed. And the first rebreather or scuba gear was developed in a garage in the 1930s by an OSS man named Dr. Christian Lambertson. And Lambertson, in 1942, was just a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania. And he would have to skip classes, and he wouldn't even be able to tell his dean what he was up to. But he had taken an old World War I gas mask and bicycle parts from a pump and constructed the first scuba gear or rebreather. And a rebreather is slightly different than scuba in the sense that you're able to rebreathe your air, and therefore the telltale sign of bubbles don't exist underwater, which is crucial to be, you know, if you're an underwater operative. The OSS developed all sorts of cool gadgets, like watches and wetsuits. They were one of the first units to actually use the fins and face masks. And then they even had these inflatable mattresses that had motors on the back. And for instance, Frank Monteleone utilized one of those to infiltrate behind the lines in Italy.
Who was the leader at this point in time? I believe from the introductory chapters to your book, I believe it was as much as anybody, Italy, who was far, far ahead of the United States when it came to these kind of innovations and these kind of operations. Why was that?
You're absolutely correct. Italy was sort of the first SEALs, if you will. And they changed the course of the war in December 1941 in the cold waters outside of Alexandria Harbor, where the British had their Eastern Mediterranean fleet. And six Italian divers that were riding kind of torpedoes that had been specially modified with warheads, they sank two major battleships as well as a couple support ships in the harbor. And these six men changed the course of World War II. The balance of power in the Eastern Mediterranean had changed by asymmetric warfare. Six men, six special operators, basically changed that the course of the war. And what happened is the major powers, including the United States, realized that they didn't have the technology or the capabilities. And this raid in Alexandria could sort of set up an underwater arms race. And all the major powers started to compete. In World War II, America did not have SEALs or even special operators, but the person that had that vision was William Donovan in the OSS. And they created something called the Maritime Unit within the OSS. And it's an interesting crew of men. Donovan handpicked most of the men that were the core of this unit, including a naval officer from the Royal Navy who was an attaché in Washington, D.C., but before the war, he was a scriptwriter in Hollywood. And they chose him, and another core character in this book, or main character, is a dentist from Hollywood, California, that the scriptwriter knew very well, Jack Taylor. And Taylor is not an ordinary dentist. This is a man that sailed halfway around the world by himself before the war. He was a pilot. And I think the most extraordinary thing I found out is he was kind of the ultimate survivor even before World War II. He dug his way out of a gold mine in the Klondike after he was buried alive.
I liked the description that was given by, I think it was maybe Donovan himself, who you say had a real gift for choosing just the right person for some of these very special missions, and in many cases they would not be necessarily the people you would, the kind of people you would immediately think of as being right for this kind of work. You write, Donovan recruited people from all walks of life. Safecrackers recently paroled from prison joined Ivy League graduates from the country's leading law firms and corporations. Tough, battle-hardened Marines worked alongside the most elegant of debutantes. Donovan considered an ideal candidate someone with, quote, a PhD who could win a bar fight, unquote. I mean, that's so interesting and good for us to know because when, for instance, Hollywood depicts heroism, it isn't always with that sort of level of complexity. I mean, it's so often kind of the Sylvester Stallone types who we see doing courageous things. But in fact, that courage and vision and imagination came in a sense in all shapes and sizes.
Absolutely, and these Renaissance men and women were extraordinary during World War II, and then even more sometimes extraordinary after the war in what they did to change American society. And in most cases, they saved many lives and invented and innovated many things. For me, I've interviewed 4,000, I think, or more World War II veterans, and I think the men and women of the OSS were the most extraordinary people that I've ever known, and most interesting. And in most cases, though, they maintained their vows of silence throughout the war and secrecy. So they were a very hard group to gain their trust initially, and then once I've been doing the interviews with them for at least 12 or 13 years, maybe more, 15 years. But once I was able to get into that group and then interview them, I gained their trust. And, you know, I think some of the most extraordinary stories of World War II reside in the minds of a few remaining veterans, as well as hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of documents that are at the National Archives in Washington, D.C.
We're speaking with Patrick O'Donnell, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called First Seals, The Untold Story of the Forging of America's Most Elite Unit. This is about, in a sense, the infancy of the U.S. Navy SEALs and some of the ways in which they made an incredibly important difference in the waging of the Second World War. One of the things I so appreciate about the approach that you take is that you, in a sense, leave no stone unturned in telling the details of this story, including, for instance, when it came to trying to put together this elite naval or maritime unit quickly, that a challenge such as where to do this training, let alone the whole matter of the equipment and the technology and developing the know-how, but just finding a place to do it, to do this kind of extraordinary, groundbreaking training, that in and of itself proved to be a really interesting and vexing challenge. Tell our listeners eventually about Area D, which was ultimately one of the first important training grounds for this work.
I love how everything with the OSS maritime unit was kind of done on a shoestring. And Area D is sort of a classic example. It's located. It's still there. There's a bunch of kind of old weeds and the remains of some knockdown buildings and a rusted old chain that says keep out. And it's directly across the river from Quantico, Virginia, a place called Smith Point. And the entire Washington, D.C. area was turned into a spy training ground in World War II. The OSS, for instance, commandeered the Congressional Country Club and trained many of their operatives, including some of the maritime unit men there. The Area D was, they shipped in some of the buildings from a local CCC camp, this is Civilian Conservation Corps camp, and erected them there. And the operatives themselves, because they were short on manpower, had to construct these things. And, you know, it's fascinating. The OSS didn't have a submarine, for instance. You kind of need a submarine to launch SEALs and stuff like that. And so what they did is they went to the Washington Yacht Club and they rented a rotting old cabin cruiser called the Maribel. And, you know, they outfitted this thing. Because what's interesting is all the boats, for instance, on the East Coast, or most of the cabin cruisers, were press-ganged into service to watch out for German U-boats. And so there was hardly even a cabin cruiser around. So they got kind of the worst of the worst, and they had to overhaul this Maribel, and they used it as a makeshift sub outside of Area D. And I'll never forget the stories that I found in the archives where they learned navigation and they learned how to infiltrate behind the lines, because the entire East Coast there were armed guards looking out for German submarines as well as spies, etc. And the men of the maritime unit had to infiltrate without the guards knowing it behind their lines, if you will, and go to finish up objectives. And this could be kind of dangerous, especially when the guards themselves were armed. And it's fascinating how this super secret spy camp, that the army wasn't around, they didn't have enough guards around, so they hired a bunch of aging guys with shotguns to guard the facility for a couple weeks before the army showed up with armed guards and everything else. It's just a fascinating story.
Incredible.
Of how this all of this technology and the approaches and the capabilities of the Navy SEALs, these men operated much like today's SEALs, where they blend special operations and intelligence gathering into their missions.
Right. And that blending of approaches was very important, something that Donovan came up with. You say a combined arms shadow warfare. He saw espionage, propaganda, sabotage, and other covert operations as the modern counterparts of sapping and mining in the siege warfare of former days. One of my favorite moments in the book is the opening of Chapter 3, which talks about the race to develop the technology needed to carry some of this out. And I like how you start that chapter by saying that the Americans, in their race to catch up, were both inspired and alarmed by the feats of the Italian frogmen. I think that's really interesting. I have a feeling a lot of desperate innovation takes place because of that combination of being inspired and alarmed by what your enemy is able to accomplish.
Absolutely. It's something that I've actually sort of specialized in to some degree with it in places like DARPA and otherwise. It's called science in crisis, and how ideas are born in chaos and also in the sort of the crucible of compressed time when things, there's a race against the clock. And if you study, for instance, the German technology war effort during World War II, how sort of what's amazing is how this technology that we like stealth technology, for instance, and jet engines were developed in this compression of time, and how so many ideas, when there's this crucible of need, some of the greatest innovations occur. And that's exactly what happened with the OSS Maritime Unit. And they were not, they recognized that the brilliance of the Italians, and when they, you know, what's extraordinary is how in World War II, after the invasion of Italy, the Italian nation, for the most part, changed sides, and a large portion of the Italian divers, known as Decima Moths, fought for the Allies, and the OSS saw, this is out of the box, the opportunity to co-opt these men. And then they basically had the part of Decima Moss fight for the OSS, and they took all of that technology that these men developed and then incorporated it into the OSS. And this technology exists today, as well as the capabilities that were developed by the Italians and the OSS.
I appreciate the fact that you talk not only about the role of technology in these special operations, and of course the courage and the guts and the extraordinary physical training of these operatives, but also the fact that they were also often men who had an incredible gift for working well with the local population. You write at one point, because of their unique backgrounds, which included archaeology and anthropology in many cases, the OSS operatives often displayed an unparalleled cultural awareness, which they needed to operate with the local population effectively. That is sometimes a crucial ingredient that is not fully appreciated, and when it's neglected, it can really lead to disaster.
Absolutely. We see it today in Iraq and elsewhere, where cultural awareness is sort of the key. A couple of years ago, for instance, human terrain teams kind of came out in Afghanistan and Iraq, and this is something that the OSS was doing in 1942 and 1943. In fact, the modern-day SEALs, as well as Green Berets and other special operators, have looked back at what the OSS was doing for lessons learned. And have applied a lot of this stuff to today. And there's many lessons that can be learned. And I think the cultural awareness piece is extremely valuable. For instance, the OSS had an anthropologist all throughout North Africa. And during the invasion of North Africa, known as Operation Torch, they were able to work directly with the tribes and Bedouins of North Africa to help affect the landings. And this occurred throughout all OSS operations, where the locals were co-opted. In many cases, local agents were even used behind the lines, and that includes the maritime unit. They were very effective in bringing in that local kind of angle.
You know, the average American does not fully appreciate the significance of, I don't know what we want to call it, the Mediterranean front of the Second World War. I mean, we tend to so often focus our attention and what we remember are the headlines made either in the European front or in the Far Eastern theater. But we often do not remember the significant role that the Mediterranean Sea played in the Second World War. And, of course, that was the primary theater for this kind of operation that you talk about in your book. What were the most crucial things going on in this facet of the war, and what kind of difference did our own OSS make in the waging of the war on this particular front?
There's so many stories that are small that I was even surprised at when I wrote this book. For instance, there was even something called the Mini Pearl Harbor or the Second Pearl Harbor, where German planes bombed and destroyed over 50 Allied ships in a harbor at Barry Harbor, for instance, in Italy. And what's interesting is there was a ship that was laden with mustard gas, and this had exploded throughout the harbor. And the maritime unit guys were pressed into service to save many of the sailors that had gone down with the ships, and they were contaminated with the mustard gas. And this was an incident that was covered up for 50 years, and in many Italian civilians were even affected by the raid. There's small incidents like that sort of come out in the book. But another thing that was very interesting is how entire warehouses full of arms and boots and other gear from the Italian army kind of fell into Allied hands, especially the OSS, when Italy changed sides. And the OSS recognized the importance of this, and they started to ship this stuff over to Tito. And you have in the book, one of the other most extraordinary men is Sterling Hayden, this movie actor that played General Jack Ripper in Dr. Strangelove. He and Taylor and some of the other men, they take a fishing boat called the Yankee, and they repurpose it to put a 50 caliber machine gun on it, and they start to ferry the supplies from the Italian army that they just captured over to partisans that were fighting the Germans. They tie down multiple German divisions by sending all these munitions and weapons over to the partisans. And then there's another extraordinary story of how Taylor and Hayden have to get out a plane load of nurses that crashed behind the lines in Albania. And this mission went all the way up to the President of the United States in terms of importance. The C-47 had crash landed behind the lines in Albania. And Albania was kind of like Iraq. It was an insurgency, a multiple insurgency kind of place, where you had different factions fighting with one another. And then you also had a German occupation. So this is one of the most dangerous parts of Europe at the time. And they have to get the nurses out somehow. And they send in, Taylor and Hayden organize the mission, and then they send in sort of this unlikely kind of guy, Lloyd Smith, who's a wrestler from Pennsylvania. And Smith is armed only with a .357 Magnum from Hayden that he won in a poker game, that he somehow has to navigate through this insurgency, this soup of groups that are fighting one another, as well as the Germans. And he traverses mountains and everything else, and he's able to bring the nurses out. And he doesn't do it just once, but he does it twice after one group of nurses becomes separated in the initial mission, five of them. And he goes back again and brings them out.
One of the things as we kind of hear about something like that, we realize that choosing the right men for some of these missions was, and particularly when we're talking about these combat swimmers, as they came to be known, choosing the right men to undertake that had to be so tricky. I mean, they were going after championship-level swimmers and experienced lifeguards and so on. But, being a competitive swimmer or being an attentive lifeguard, that doesn't in and of itself make you the right man for the job for some of these extraordinarily dangerous, perilous missions. Tell us what it took to be a successful combat swimmer within this OSS operation.
These were really, the way it was summed up as the PhD that could win a bar fight. Many of these guys were super athletes. In fact, we just lost one of those combat swimmers last week Gordon Salto, who is a Pro Bowl kicker for the San Francisco 49ers. And he was an extraordinary individual that had conducted many of these missions, along with, you know, they also went after guys that were national championship and Olympic caliber swimmers to do the combat swimming type work that they wanted completed, as well as men that were expert seamen that prior to the war had piloted either yachts or boats or ships, and they had kind of had this whole. The OSS Maritime Unit, in many ways, is sort of an elite within the OSS. They were highly skilled individuals that were very smart.
One of the most amazing things to think about is how all of this had to develop so quickly and yet so carefully. I think that's one of the things that I find most astonishing. I mean, that the clock was ticking, and of course some mistakes were made, but it's astonishing how few mistakes were made, given how high the stakes were and how quickly so much of this had to be put into place. To what do you attribute that? The fact that all of this was pulled off as successfully as it was, given the less than ideal circumstances under which this was all put together.
It's extraordinary. And then you also have within that sort of set, this race against time, against the Axis, you also have competition within the United States by either the U.S. Navy sometimes directly, other branches that don't agree with the OSS's approach, but somehow these guys were able to pull it off, and they were able to build – it's a great story of leadership as well as sort of management style. These men were able to achieve – they were able to build consensus and take raw ideas and turn them into reality, not only the technology but also the capabilities. That's what I think is so extraordinary about these first SEALs.
It's an extraordinary story, and we've just scratched the surface of it in this conversation, and I urge you to take this book in hand and explore it thoroughly to learn more about this extraordinary undertaking and the huge difference which it made in the Allied effort in the Second World War. The book is called First Seals, The Untold Story of the Forging of America's Most Elite Unit, published by Da Capo Press, and the book includes some very intriguing and helpful photographs that help us know these men even better and help us better understand the perilous work which they were doing. And the author is Patrick O'Donnell. Patrick O'Donnell, you've done it again with yet another fascinating best-selling book, and I look forward to our first future conversations about your future books and wish you well.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. As always, your questions were probing, and you really, you know, got the essence of the book. So it's always a pleasure to come on your show.
Thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you again. And the time is 8:43. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. And just when you think that every fascinating story of the Second World War has already been told, here comes yet another fascinating but largely untold story. It's in a book called 12 Desperate Miles, the epic World War II voyage of the SS Contessa. This is a story which hooks into actually a monumentally important undertaking in the Second World War, Operation Torch, which was the Allies' first big move against the Axis powers, invading certain important ports in northern Africa. And anyone who knows, for instance, the story of General Patton knows something about Operation Torch. But within that great military undertaking is this smaller story, this essential story of a particular boat, the SS Contessa, which is just one of a number of vessels that were involved in this gigantic undertaking. But the circumstances under which this particular boat was a participant are particularly interesting. The story told in this book by author Tim Brady, who is a veteran history writer and writes frequently for, among others, the History Channel. And this book is published by Crown, again called 12 Desperate Miles. And Tim Brady, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I look forward to talking with you a little more about this really fascinating story. Obviously, as someone who knows history as well as you do, you knew something about Operation Torch before you even began writing this book. But this book obviously had a focus on a sort of a smaller story within that larger story. How did you ever even find out about the SS Contessa?
Well, I was reading a bigger history of the invasion of North Africa, Rick Atkinson's book on that subject, and I saw in his book this little anecdote, and since I do a lot of magazine writing, history magazine writing, I just sort of made note of it and thought it would be a good magazine story. The more I dug into it, however, the bigger it got, and it turned into this book.
So tell us, first of all, a little bit about Operation Torch. I mean, very briefly, why the Allied effort against the Axis began with this kind of operation. What was the hope of what would be accomplished?
Well, there was much question in 1942 about how the U.S. would enter the World War II. The initial American idea was to attack the Axis powers directly from England across the English Channel, the attack that ultimately became D-Day. The British were strongly opposed to this. They thought it would be suicidal. It would wreck the Allies before they even got going. So the alternatives were considered, and one was to attack North Africa, to invade North Africa.
And the idea, of course, was not only that this is not a direct assault on Nazi Germany itself, but it's sort of attacking, in a sense, its flank, rear flank maybe. But your book tells us that part of the hope was that in this sort of attack it would force Nazi Germany to sort of swing its attention elsewhere, and maybe in such a way that Europe itself would sort of be a different playing field than it was before Operation Torch was undertaken. Am I remembering that correctly?
Exactly. And the greatest consideration at the moment was the extreme pressure that the Soviet Union was under at the time, and the through by Germany. They were being assaulted at Stalingrad, and Stalin needed relief from these Nazi pressures, and the Allies thought that they could both relieve those pressures on the Eastern Front and have a less challenging assault on the Axis powers in North Africa. Now, I don't mean to belittle what happened in North Africa at all, but just to say that rather than attacking the Nazis frontally across the English Channel, the attack in North Africa, the first forces they would face were the French forces defending the Vichy French interests in North Africa.
We're ultimately talking in this undertaking about hundreds of ships and many thousands of troops heading to North Africa from both America and Britain. Mm-hmm. And in amongst them is this very unlikely ship that ends up being part of this monumental project, namely this SS Contessa, which is in effect a humble little banana boat. How is it that a ship like that would end up being even a small part of an operation like this, let alone an ultimately important part of Operation Torch?
You know, that was the very question that animated my interest in this book, in doing this book from the beginning. The fact of the matter is that in the course of planning the invasion of North Africa, George Patton decided that there was an airport in Morocco that would be crucial to his plans to invade Casablanca, and so he determined that airport needed to be taken, and that airport also needed to be supplied with gasoline and munitions, so that he could use the airport as a base for his assault on Casablanca. Now, the port was 12 miles up a very shallow river in Morocco, and at the start of the planning for the invasion, it was determined that Patton decided that he had to get a ship up that river to supply the airport. There was one ship that the Navy and other forces in the operations could find in the Atlantic that could make that journey, and it was this banana boat, the Contessa.
One of the ways in which we sort of appreciate the unlikelihood, the absurdity of this rusty old vessel being part of all this is the picture that you paint right at the start of chapter one of your book, in which you say something to the effect that one of the most important sort of almost like battle lines or battlefields of the Second World War, although nobody exactly saw it that way at the time, was the harbor of New York City and the array of vessels that were there and in other places along the American Eastern Seaboard that were sort of gathering strength for some sort of strike against the Axis. But you sort of paint this picture of this impressive armada growing more impressive by the day, but also the very real threat of German submarines very, very close off of our east coast. A very tangible threat to our military well-being. It's a really interesting question, picture you paint there, and it helps us understand the odd role that the SS Contessa plays in that.
Yeah, and I think it's a picture that people have forgotten through the years, because you know the story of World War II is such a huge story, and what was to come in 1942 ultimately sort of put the early picture of the war in the background. But what we should remember that the war on Europe didn't really begin until almost a year after Pearl Harbor, and for that first year of the war, the United States itself was under attack through these U-boat assaults that were happening really on a daily basis almost on the eastern seaboard. Hundreds of ships were lost to the German submarine attacks, and so you have to get a portrait of the eastern seaboard as the war is beginning, and the preparations for the war involve moving ships here and there, transporting troops to England and transporting supplies to the Soviet Union, and there's a lot of activity on the eastern seaboard, but there's at the same time there's this assault being undertaken by German forces. So it's a frightening time for people living along the coast.
Absolutely. So there is this plan then conceived, and all of these ships moving across the Atlantic, and rather hurriedly, when it's discovered that a very sort of special kind of vessel is going to be needed for this particular operation involving this 12-mile stretch of river, which which would take the Allies to this really crucial air base that the SS Contessa is rather hurriedly added to the mix. Where was the Contessa at this time, and where was its crew?
Well, the Contessa, at the start of the organization of the convoy to go to North Africa, was not a part of that operation. It was transporting troops from New York, American troops from New York to Ireland and Britain, England. And so it had been making runs back and forth between New York and Northern Ireland and England and back to New York. So that's where it was when it was determined that this was the only ship. And I should add that it was because it was a banana boat, it carried cargo from South and Central America, fruit and bananas from South and Central America to New Orleans. That was what its original intent was. It had a very shallow draft, and it could go up these South American rivers to plantations to pick up cargo. That was what made it essential, ideal for the trip up the river in Morocco. At any rate, it was during the war, it was making these transport runs. And then it was discovered by Patton and company, and was called to Norfolk, Virginia, to get ready for this convoy trip across the Atlantic to Morocco and up the river. When it arrived in Norfolk, it was late for the operation. It was called in at the last minute. When the ship pulled into the Hampton Roads Harbor in Norfolk, the captain of the ship dismissed his crew. He thought that he wasn't certain what was next. He'd just gotten an order to sail to Norfolk. He let his crew go. They went off to have fun in the wilds of Norfolk, and soon thereafter the powers that be in the convoy came to the captain and said, "You need to sail immediately to North Africa." And he was missing half of his crew.
Hmm. So you're one of the things your book tells us is about sort of the scramble to get this ship, the Contessa, staffed. And they even turned to the local jail for at least some of the crew that ended up making the trip, correct?
That is correct. Norfolk at the time was a pretty wild town. It was it had for 100 years it had been a East Coast seaport, so it had that tradition of a lot of seamen getting out and carousing after long voyages. To add to that, during the war, it was just filled with thousands and thousands of soldiers who were getting ready to ship out. The bar scene in Norfolk was thick, and so you can imagine the crew gets out, they head out to the streets of Norfolk, and now the captain finds out he has to sail to North Africa. There was no one to be found. So they went to the Norfolk County Jail and wound up getting 18 seamen who had spent the weekend carousing and were tossed into the brig and now had to sober up and immediately sail off to North Africa.
And of course, they end up missing the protection of the convoy for at least a large part of the trip. One of the things your book has is a map which shows the main body of this naval force making the trip. And then here's, I think, this little dotted line which depicts the route of the SS Contessa. And for the majority of the trip, it's on its own crossing the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, that in and of itself is an amazing story.
It was really quite frightening. The convoy is 100 ships, and they've sailed 2 days before the Contessa finally gets out of port. So the Contessa is essentially 2 days behind the convoy, and you know, a 100-ship convoy leaves a pretty large mark on the ocean as it sails. So that the U-boats who were out hunting anything that moved.